Welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, a monthly potpourri of literary snacks for the mind and interviews. I'm Sandy Harper here with my co-host Dick Reichman and our very special guest, Nat Reichman. And I'd like to take a moment for full disclosure. Nat is Dick's son and now a very successful Emmy Award-winning music producer and mixing engineer specializing in contemporary classical music and soundtracks for television. And just as a side note, before we begin our conversation, you know, Dick, you're a playwright, director, and actor, and I think it's fascinating that one of your sons grew up to be an audio guy, and your other son, Ben, is a visual guy involved in filmmaking. So were you surprised, or did you have an inkling when they were kids growing up in Valdez?
Well, they were very entertaining, so I figured the entertainment value was there.
Well, now you were mentioning that having a dad in public broadcasting at that time kind of gave you an intro and an interest in audio.
Well, at the time, and the Alaska audience will know about this, at the time, my father was working at KCHU in Valdez, and after hours at KCHU, I learned how to edit audio on the old tape decks there. So now when I see engineers in my career, they give me more respect when I tell them that I learned on an original tape deck.
That's like learning the stick shift.
Exactly. You learn to drive on a stick shift, you actually know how to drive. So when
I became the fastest editor on a half-track machine that I've ever met, and that's a skill that's totally unnecessary. As a matter of fact, to find a working half-track machine, it's very difficult.
So I was 15 and 16 learning how to cut analog tape. And it was absolutely fascinating because all the things I was imagining I could do, roughly. And then day one at college, I saw an early version of a piece of software that would eventually become Pro Tools. And my jaw dropped. I said, that's it. I'm not turning back. I'm never going to touch tape again. And I think I was one of, you know, a million people who said that. And since then, tape has become a luxury that nobody can afford. So,
although vinyl records are coming back. You know,
yes, vinyl is coming back.
Which is interesting. Yes. Well, you know, you have worked with so many extraordinary people. And, of course, my granddaughter was most impressed that you worked with Blues Clues.
That's right.
What's that like to create the sound for a popular kids series? I know you have ones, you know, Emmy Award-winning ones now.
Well, I have to take you back a little bit, especially when we talk about Blues Clues. Early in my career, I was working in advertising. Mm-hmm. And I was working with a couple of composers who were really good, and they were embarking on a career making music for TV commercials. And then one of them had a friend who said, oh, we're thinking about starting this thing as a TV show. Would you like to work on it? Sure. And it was this side project. And I even remember at the time somebody saying, oh, that would be a nice feather in our cap to be working on a TV show as a side thing while we focus on making TV commercials. Mm-hmm. Little did we know that we were going to spend 10 years in the number one slot ahead of Sesame Street.
Wow.
You know.
I didn't realize that a decade. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and so Blue's Clues took off like wildfire. And I was very young when I was working on Blue's Clues. I had to go back and finish college. And I came back and continued working with that team. And I should just mention a couple of names. Michael Rubin and Nick Balaban are great composers that I learned a lot from during that time. And then Blue's Clues, as you know, went on to become one of the biggest kids TV shows for about 10 years. And then going from that project, we've subsequently worked on a lot of children's television shows. And it wasn't my intent in life to work in children's TV, but it's something that chose me. So,
like in Shakespeare, thrust upon you.
Yes, exactly. It's thrust upon you. You can't ignore it. Here it is. So,
you know, how does it work? I looked at your website that you told me about. I love the sampling that you did, but how it gets created, maybe you could reveal some of the mystery.
Well, one of the things, these big projects happen with a lot of people. And so there's a kind of imaginary idea that there's a single composer who's dreaming up ideas for this television show. And that's really not the case. You always work on a team of people and you play to their strengths. So one composer is particularly good at writing jazz, one's good at writing songs, another one is classically trained. And so in all fairness, it becomes very much like a factory. So, but there's nothing wrong with that. And I think that's something that I think as any artist does work in quantity, you begin to refine your craft and you get better at it. And at the beginning of my career, I looked down on commercial work and industry work, things that would be on major networks, you know, because it was fashionable to say, well, that's not real art.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You
know? I've met some of the greatest, you know, the greatest artists I know in my life are the ones that I've worked with on television shows. Right. And it's because you're able to hone your craft and you do it again and again and again, season after season. And after you've done 100 episodes of a certain show, you get good at it.
Yeah, you become a master.
Yeah.
Was it through that experience that you met Philip Glass or started working with him?
That was a whole separate thread. And actually, these two things in my life are very funny. I should explain. I sort of have two parallel careers going on. We're paying the bills with television, but I'm very lucky also to work with composers on straight classical projects. So there's a famous film director some of the audience will know, Godfrey Reggio. Mm. And in 1978, Godfrey Reggio came out with a movie called Koyani Skatsi.
I love that film.
And yeah, a lot of people remember that film fondly. And in the early days of Koyani Skatsi, Godfrey had been a Catholic monk and had left the church and decided to be a filmmaker one afternoon. And he was shooting early versions of Koyani Skatsi in black and white. And he didn't quite know how to do it. And there was a certain milieu around him. The sort of beat poet culture was winding down. Gregory Corso was there. Friends of Philip Glass were there. And Godfrey and Philip started working together. And when I was working in Italy, I began to get to know that team. And I was very lucky when they made, so this is 1978, before my time, when they made the first movie. The third movie, Nakoi Katsi, was produced by Steven Soderbergh, who's a big fan of Godfrey's. And we worked on that in New York for over a year. The whole production team actually worked on it for about 2.5 years. And I was on that movie for about a year. And it was, nobody ever gets that much time to work on a movie. So it was a really unusual opportunity. And Godfrey had big dreams for that film. And it's out, I think, it's easy to see right now. It's in a lot of places.
And for those who don't know, it's sheer poetry, philosophical wisdom, both in the visuals and the audio, you know.
I
guess he has a brand new one out too. It's read at the Toronto Film Festival called The Visitor or something.
Yeah, in fact, Francis Kuipers, who's a music producer I was working with on Nakoi Katsi, we got to see some early versions of that. But I haven't seen the finished copy yet.
In Toronto, they said they had the Toronto Symphony was playing live to the images in the film. That would be fabulous.
Well, that was when an interesting thing happened. When I started working with that team, it was a real pleasure to meet Philip Glass. But then back to the team idea that I was talking about with television, he himself had said in various occasions that he wouldn't be where he is without a great team around him. And he has terrific producers and a lot of really wonderful artists around him making that music and making that work. And that's who I really got to know. And there's a famous director and piano player, Michael Reisman, who I was working with during that time. And the movie, the third in the series, didn't have the same commercial impact that the first did. But the Philip Glass Ensemble has toured with that. And the tour has been, over the last 5-10 years, very successful.
That's very exciting.
And so I regularly hear about performances of that around the world. And
with pride.
Yes, exactly, with a lot of pride. Exactly.
Yeah. And then, of course, you have connected with a very famous Alaskan composer, too.
John. Yeah, that's right. Well, and actually, I should back up on this, too. There's just because of my age and what I studied in college, when I left college, there was an interesting thing happening. There was a generation of older composers whose careers were really taking off. At the same time, there was a whole new generation of technology that was required to make new pieces of music.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a juncture. I was in exactly the right place at the right time. So I was able to work with a lot of older composers who needed somebody who could basically run the computer. And so as an editor, I was able to work with Jonathan Adams and Michael Small, the late Michael Small, who is a fabulous film composer, Francis Kuipers, and also Philip Glass. And early in my career, very early in my career, I was making coffee and ordering lunch. And then after that, I became an editor. And in the last few years, I now have produced a number of the albums for John Luther Adams.
How extraordinary. So,
and John's career, as many Alaskans know, has really taken off, and his music is getting played all around the world. So there are pieces we've worked on a few years ago that every week I have ensembles from around the world that are asking for materials and scores and learning how to play his pieces.
Is that like a playwright? You get a royalty when new and different people perform the work?
It depends on where and how it's played. There is a royalty system for playing it in concert halls and theaters. But the best royalty system by far for artists is the one that's on the radio and television. And so there's that's a great opportunity for any artist. You know, if you've written a piece of music and somebody wants to use it in a TV show, no matter how good or bad the TV show is, you should say yes.
So we're talking to Nathaniel Reichman, music producer. And so you've had a connection here in Alaska with John Luther Adams. Any other Alaskan known projects that people listening might be aware of?
I can't say that there is. And actually, what's odd about that is that John and I didn't meet in Alaska. We met in Vermont.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. But we were back. We spent many many days in his studio outside of Fairbanks working on some of his earlier pieces together. And that was a real pleasure. But in case I'm forgetting another project, but I'm not sure that I am.
I don't know. I don't think so.
You just Dick just wanted to know.
That's right.
Exactly. Out. Well, it sounds like you're extraordinarily busy. I mean, is it 9 to 5 or 24/7 or how does it work?
We work in bursts and I try to, now that I have a family, I try to work 9 to 5. We used to work 10 to 10. That was our usual schedule. But now that I have kids, I try to do 9 to 5 and then stop and then go back to the studio in the evening. You know.
Right, so. Do they have the same experience you have as a kid? I mean, because you're working with a lot of children's television, so that must be very impressive.
Well, actually, one of the highlights, working on the Philip Glass project was wonderful. And then after Nakhoikatse, we worked on Orion. Mm-hmm. And then after Orion wound down, I was trying to figure out what the next step was. And a collaborator of mine, Nick Balaban, who's a terrific jazz composer and songwriter, we worked on a TV show called Word World. And Word World was partly funded by the Department of Education and out on PBS. And it was there to teach kids how to read. And at the time, my first son was just learning how to read. So I had the focus group at home,
perfect.
And it was a wonderful combination. And Nick and I really loved that project. It was really out of all the TV shows, all the children's TV shows we've worked on, that's one we feel very strongly about.
So, do they give you a storyboard, or how do you compose the music or make the music?
Mm. Yeah, actually, the animation process. I've always found really interesting. It's all script driven. And we do something, and I think a lot of people have seen this on television with big Hollywood movies. You hire a bunch of great actors, and in an afternoon, you can put together an entire episode and make what they call the radio play.
Mm-hmm.
And so every episode of an animated, every animated movie and every episode of an animated series starts out as a radio play. And we work very hard in the radio play to make sure that what you're hearing audio only of each character speaking, the timing and the humor and the drama, and we have all the right takes for the lines. If that's perfect, then you can make a storyboard with still images of what the characters are doing with that radio play. And those two things, the radio play and the storyboard, are turned over to giant teams of animators that will slave away on those two pieces of media for 5 or 6 months. And then when you come out of the animation pipeline, and I would talk more about this if I knew this, but I'm in the music and audio business, so it's a little bit of a black box. I see the radio play and the storyboard go into one side of the box, and 5 months later, on the other side of the box, you get beautiful animation, which still needs to be edited. And we're on both sides of that. My friend Nick, as a songwriter, will write songs that will go into the radio play. And then when they come out fully animated, we get a whole lot of new ideas. So we take the song apart completely, and we re-record all the parts with musicians and additional singers. And as a producer, I'm in charge of making sure that all components of the score are going in. So all the underscore is happening. The musicians are showing up on time. We've chosen the right singer. Where is it being recorded? Who's mixing it? When is it done? And then that's how we get to the final destination when we make an episode for TV.
So you put all the pieces together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting is live TV... I've occasionally, because I've worked so much in children's media, I would occasionally tell people about the times I've worked in adult television. And I say, no, I don't mean that. I mean primetime. I've worked on a couple of shows. I worked on Whoopi Goldberg's show, and I worked on a show that had a really strong following for a little while called Ed. And those shows, oddly, are cheaper to produce because you can script and shoot and edit a show like that in a matter of weeks instead of a matter of months. And so I fear a little bit for the animation industry, because as media gets more fragmented, it's very hard to spend that much money on an individual animated episode. You know.
Well, there's a lot of respect for animation now, like Pixar. There is. Difference.
Yeah, there is.
Doesn't technology, though, make animation simpler?
Well, like anything, technology is an enabler of any creative artist. You still need artists, you know. I often think, I regularly run into people who buy a faster computer and think they're going to write better music because they've got the new version of their Mac laptop, right? And no, you're stuck writing the same music you were writing yesterday before you bought that computer. So, it does. There are some gains to It is cheaper to build the server farm you need to do the animation, but you still need dozens and dozens of talented animators to think about what a character is going to look like on the screen and how they're going to react to something, drama. And actually, this is a good moment for me to bring up something as well. Hanging out with my father while he was rehearsing plays has really helped me in television, because all those dramatic beats, working on a script with a group of actors and figuring out what they need to do, all the things that you guys do at Cyrano's regularly, is all that stuff, growing up having that around me, really helped me when I went to television.
That's very interesting. Yeah. I mean, the whole point is musicality, I mean, a good production of a play.
And actually, a lot of these shows are musicals, and musicals sort of fell out of favor in adult media, but in children's media, it's a big deal. And the hardest thing to do is to convincingly move from straight dialogue and into song, and then back out of song, back to straight dialogue. And if you can do that as a script writer or as a songwriter, it's a great success, you know.
How rewarding that must be when you make that score. I'm wondering, too, when you were a child, did you ever see Fantasia? If you did that influence you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, if you listen carefully to any major children's television show, you will hear everything that the composers were listening to. I regularly turn on shows and I hear John Williams, and I hear the B-52s, and I hear Devo, and I hear Tchaikovsky, and all these influences come together. And honestly, I mean, I am talking about commercial work. Mm-hmm. And so the artists I work with, we often use these as reference points and say, we really want this to sound like this piece of Stravinsky's, right? We're not going to do that, but we're going to be inspired by that. Right, that arrangement.
But the point is, you have the frame of reference.
Right, we have the frame of reference, and say that was the way that arrangement worked, the way he used the winds in this certain passage. This is fabulous. We want to do something similar, you know. And so you can, in one way, you can be critical of that and say, okay, that work is derivative, but it is commercial, and commercial work is a reflection of what has happened in the recent and even distant past in kind of sort of fine art. You know.
Yeah. Well. You know, we're finding out more and more the importance of music and sound. I'm thinking of Oliver Sacks now.
Yeah.
And so that's all very interesting. Somehow it sticks with you. Music does.
Yeah.
Sound does.
We're talking to Nathaniel Reichman, a music producer. Nat, you're also a composer. To what extent does your personal composition come into this TV work?
Well, a little bit. I've written a handful of cues here and there. But as people have often heard me say, I know so many fabulous composers that it's been better for me to be on the other side of the glass in the recording studio and to record these terrific composers. Once in a while, an opportunity comes up and I do write something.
Is it something that's sort of incubated and just kind of flows out, or are you deliberately trying to compose?
I don't think that... anything in commercial television ever flowed out. You're under high pressure. You just have to get it done.
So it's the deadline.
It's the time pressure. Yeah, the last time I wrote a few cues, it was because the deadline was looming, and I thought, okay, I can write these cues. This is not too complicated. And I went and wrote them. And I think that's I think it's important for any artist to know. It's actually good to have deadlines, because then it forces you to commit.
That's true, isn't it, Dick?
It forces. I think, you know, an artist without a deadline, unless you are incredibly disciplined, you're asking for trouble, you know.
Some authors take years and years and years to write
exactly.
their novel.
exactly.
Well, I just think it's so exciting what you're doing, Nat. And So you grew up in Valdez. Okay, so you had the advantage of having a dad who had a radio job. So you thought you had your calling. So how did you, how did the, that path lead you to where you went to school? And on your resume, it mentioned something called Fabrica. I don't know what that is.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe you could tell us about that, too.
Well, actually, I didn't go to college with music in mind.
Mm-hmm.
I went to college with theater in mind. And my first year, I was fortunate enough as a freshman to be cast in a couple of the plays at the college. And the plays that they were doing that year were so awful that I was sort of disappointed and a little bit bored because I couldn't connect to the script. And at the same time, I met a composer, Joel Chatterby, who let me know that there was actually a contemporary sort of electronic music scene happening. You know, that there was a modern classical. I wasn't aware of contemporary music at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a whole group of composers at that time that really inspired me. And I'm thinking about people like Morton Subotnick and Dennis Smalley. And these are composers that I don't expect the audience to know, but they're composers writing now new classical music. And Jonathan Adams comes from that school.
Uh-huh.
Jonathan Adams is very influenced by Morton Feldman, who's an extraordinary composer, and also Lou Harrison. So when I went to Fabrica, Fabrica was a school in Italy that was started by the photographer Oliviero Toscani. And what he wanted to do at the school was, it sort of became what I'm doing in my life, which was to be at that juncture between fine art and advertising. And he had students from around the world come there, and you could make whatever you want, but you had made a deal that whatever you made could be used in European advertising.
Oh.
And so it was a fascinating school, and the school still exists, and it's a very experimental idea, and it's funded by the United Colors of Benetton. And years ago, Benetton was very interested in provocative ad campaigns, and they were very aware that good ad campaigns depended on really good artists.
And to appeal to that younger demographic, too.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so that was a really eye-opening experience. And from Fabrica, you know, it led to a lot of things. There was a film made at Fabrica that Philip Glass scored.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the early stage of me beginning to work with that team.
Oh. Did they throw in a few sweaters, too?
Yes. Yeah, we had a lot of sweaters.
That was nice.
Yeah. Yep.
And I wonder if you're familiar with music innovators like Harry Parch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, Delusions of the Fury, it was, I pull that out every Halloween because the music is so terrifying and fun and so dramatic. He might not like to know that I listen to that at Halloween, but it's, Parch, and thinking again about American composers, Parch and Lou Harrison and Ives, these are all composers who had a big impact on the current group of American composers, and you can hear that today. Those are serious. They leave a big legacy. John Luther Adams talks about something which I didn't experience because I'm the wrong generation. I think I'm trying to remember what year John was born, maybe 1953, and he talks about growing up and feeling some competition and friction between American composers and European composers.
Mm-hmm.
And just one generation later, I don't feel that at all. The group has become more internationalized, you know.
Well, it's a global world we live in,
yeah.
I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I mean, for the audience, if you're interested in listening to this, listening to composers like Boulez or John Tavener or Arvo Pärt, these are all living composers today that are writing extraordinary music, just phenomenal. And if you haven't listened to Arvo Pärt, it will blow your mind. You know, this is some of the best music ever written, and it's happening right now.
How do you spell that?
Pärt is P-A-R-T, with I think an umlaut over the A, or whether something else that I don't know how to spell exactly. But
you have inspired me to seek it out and listen.
I've seen it with two A's. Is that? P-A-A-R-T?
I've seen that too. Most commonly I see P-A-R-T, but there's something in the A. I think Pärt is Estonian.
Oh.
And I'm sure there's another way to spell his name in a different alphabet that's more accurate. So.
Well, the reason I brought up Harry Parch is many, many years ago, I was involved with a very cutting-edge avant-garde theater. And Rachel Rosenthal was a leader, and she was very involved in anything that was cutting edge in avant-garde.
Yeah.
Harry Partridge gave a concert, which we all went to, where he was trying to replicate how he imagined the Greek instruments would have sounded.
Yeah.
Because nobody really knows.
Yeah. Oh, that's fabulous. I love it when composers are experimenting with different instruments.
Yeah.
That's,
Or guys like Steve Reich who are doing different temples, I guess.
Well, I remember the first time I heard Steve Reich's Six Marimbas, and that's another piece for your audience. That's unbelievable. That in that 1 9-minute piece is the whole, you know, history of American minimalism. You know, it's more the lesson in American minimalism in that one piece. Really fabulous piece of music.
That's fantastic.
Nathaniel Reichman is our guest, musical producer. If you had your choice on the next project that you could work on, any music project, film project, television project, what would it be?
What would it be?
What
oh my God.
What would you most like to do in this business?
Two things, actually. I don't hold soundtrack music at a lower level than straight classical music. There's some wonderful soundtracks being made. And my friend Francis Kuipers and I might work on a soundtrack for director Abel Ferrara next year. We're really excited about that. And it could be a great soundtrack. So it's that project. And then another collaborator of mine, we've been talking about working on an album together.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of know what the album is about, all these influences we've had in our life and very personal music. But there's a technological difference, and this is the dream project that I'm articulating here. We've been mixing music in surround sound for a while now, but very few people hear it that way. So this dream album that we've actually begun working on is also kind of an immersive musical experience. And we can do a lot more. It's very exciting to hear live musicians because you're surrounded by that sound. But there are all these things that we can do in the studio. I often find live concerts annoying, too, because they'll be too loud or too chaotic, right? But when you move away from stereo and you start adding more speakers, it gets more and more magical. And so this is the album that the dream album that we want to finish, the surround sound album.
So does that mean we regular lay people have to have certain equipment in order to really hear it? You wish it to be heard?
Well, this is the recent history of the music industry is an awful one because right when everyone was going to install big loudspeakers and have surround sound systems in every living room, at exactly that time, Apple came out with the iPod and everyone started listening to MP3s. And so that dream has kind of been pushed aside a little bit. But I will say, in movie theaters, there's the opportunity, if you tune out the dialogue and sound effects, to hear a lot of great music in surround sound.
So. Oh, Nat, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you and to find out more about what's behind sound and how to create sound.
Thank you, Sandy.
And join us again next month for another edition of Alaska Radio Reader Rambler.